Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello, Toasters. How are you? Welcome along to a brand new episode. On the show today, the fabulous Reverend Richard Coles. This was so, so gorgeous. I had so much fun in his company. And I'm just really thrilled that you've tuned in and you're going to listen to it and you're going to really enjoy it. It's very exciting. It goes all over the place, as usual. And obviously, there's some obligatory Wales chat. I had to crack on. I've got to let everyone know I'm from Wales. I don't know why I have to do that. Anyway, we had some Wales chat at the beginning, which goes a little bit like this.
I've sort of discovered Wales, you'll be glad to hear.
It's good. Better late than never.
I've started going a couple of years, and so the bit I know is sort of that bit on the border, so Hay-on Wye, the Brecon Beacons, yeah. And then going into kind of Crickhowell and around
yes,
there. Oh, it's so beautiful.
That's my neck of the woods, Richard. Yeah, that's Monmouth is...
Well, that's lovely. Well,
yeah, it's lovely. It's so nice.
A very good friend of mine, Horatio Clare, I don't know if you know Horatio, the writer.
No.
He grew up in near Crickhowell, Cumdy. And he is the most wonderful writer. And his first book was about growing up on a sheep farm high in the Black Mountains.
Oh, really?
It's a wonderful book. You should read it.
Oh, yeah. I should. Give me that name again because I'll forget.
Horatio Clare.
Oh, great.
You can't really forget the name.
No.
And,
I can. I'm quite bad at names.
And the book, his first book, which is a memoir, is called Running for the Hills.
Oh, great.
But it's absolutely wonderful.
Add it onto my TBR. That's wonderful. Excellent. Excellent. And then we got on with the show. Hello, welcome along. It's my mate Bought a Toaster, and I am utterly thrilled, utterly delighted to welcome one of my broadcasting heroes, the very fabulous Reverend Richard Coles, who is here. And Richard, do you know what? The best way I can think of to sum you up is you're a tell them-er, right?
Now, tell them-er.
Tell them-er, right? Here's what that means. And you get them every now and again. I've told probably five or six people I'm talking to you this morning. Every single one said, oh, you must tell him. Oh, you must tell him. People have this connection to you. People absolutely love you. And they feel like they know you, Richard.
Yeah, but if only they knew.
This is what I'm hoping to do today. Can we find out the truth?
I mean, it's funny, and I think it's because I've sort of been nudged towards national treasure or borderline national trinket, as David used to call it, status. And the thing is, once you're in that frame, you could... I mean, I sometimes think I could kind of burn down my own church and people go, oh, what a lovely blaze. You know, it's as if you can't do any wrong. And I just think people knew what I was really like.
Yes.
I suppose that disappointment will come and then I'll never work again, live in the street and die a lonely death in a warehouse.
There will never be a Coles backlash. It's impossible. I refuse to believe it's possible. Even though we might find out some truths about you over the course of today, how was it? Now, I should say it's your fault you're on the show because you tweeted a while back about all the nonsense you've been buying on Amazon during lockdown. Did you have fun going back into your Amazon history?
Well, it was so interesting. It's like, you know, the truth about oneself is always a mystery, isn't it, to you, and maybe not to others. Mm. But there it is, set out for you in unsparing detail and with pictures.
Yes.
And I mean, I'm like a sort of one of the Flintstones when it begins, blundering across a keyboard, not really understanding what's going on. And by the time, it is the most unsparing index of my veniality.
It is, in Amazon Veritas. This is how it is, exactly. And we can see this straight away if we go to 2005, Richard. You know, I didn't buy one of these as a Welshman, but that's the only reason I didn't buy it. It's the official Johnny Wilkinson calendar. You're a fan of his rugby, of course.
Well, I am a fan of his rugby. But when rugby comes wrapped in such a charming package, it's even more irresistible. And in 2005, I was living... I was a curate in far off... Lincolnshire, and I just really, really... Well, do you know what? Actually, that's what I'd just come to the end of having spent 2 years in a monastery.
Wow.
As you can imagine, there weren't that many people with Johnny Wilkinson calendars up on the wall. But one of the most pleasant... We had an Australian monk there who I liked very much, and he and I bunked off church one day to watch the final of the Rugby World Cup when Johnny Wilkinson, do you remember, with that drop goal, secured victory for England.
Yes.
Yeah, over Australia. Mm. And to watch that was wonderful, but to watch it with an Australian was even better. So I've always felt very strongly warm feelings towards Johnny Wilkinson. Also, he's incredibly handsome.
He is beautiful. He is beautiful.
And he's just a really charming man as well.
Yeah.
He's Buddhist, I think, which I would rather like.
Oh, is he?
A Buddhist rugby player. Yeah.
I see. Well, that would explain his metronomic kicking. He went somewhere else when he was kicking that ball.
Didn't he? And that thing where he did that look with his hands together, almost in an attitude of prayer,
yes,
rather struck me. It reminded me of some Renaissance paintings of saints.
Yes. Is this where prayer and neuro-linguistic programming meet up? Is there? Do you think there's muscle memory when you put your hands together?
I'm sure there is. I mean, most of my life now is muscle memory and failing muscle memory at 59. So... But now I sometimes think muscle memory is all I've got. And I remember my father once absentmindedly spending a penny in his trouser press because there was something about being in front of the trouser press that triggered muscle memory in such a way as to lead to him micturating over his trousers. And I just really think that I'm on the threshold of that now myself.
That's excellent. Always blame the muscle memory. Just whenever these things start to happen.
But don't you find... I mean, I find this drive is... I'm not a very good driver, and I'm getting worse. And one of the things is that my body drives before my mind has fully engaged sometimes. And there's a tricky crossroads near me. And I've had to just really stop and look and think.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I'm worried I'll just sail across without thinking.
You don't want to do a Prince Philip. That's what he did, isn't it, when he had his crash a couple of years ago. He just sailed over.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I don't want to do that.
But the thing with driving is as soon as you start to become conscious of the... Because muscle memory, driving is the perfect example of muscle memory. But as soon as you become conscious of what you're doing, and I have this sometimes with the kids and the dog and my wife sitting next to me, I'm in the car and I'm in charge of all of their lives. And suddenly I get up in my head and think, you the wheel, you need to make sure it's... You know what I mean? You just start to become conscious.
I mean, anyone who plays an instrument knows what that's like, because once you get... sort of reasonably proficient in instrument, it is what you need to do is to be so proficient in muscle memory that you don't have to think about what you're doing and instead think about what you're playing, what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And my driving, though, I mean, I'm a reasonably proficient keyboard player and I've learnt the accordion now as well, and I'm enjoying that, but my driving just gets worse and worse. Do you know, I was turning right onto the A509, which is always a sticky one for me, and there was a bloke on a scooter, and I didn't time it very well. And I had to brake, and he had to brake. And he did a big, big wanker sign at me. And then he saw my dog collar, and he pretended he was adjusting his visor.
This is the way to avoid road rage incidents. We all need to put dog collars on.
Yes, but I'm afraid that is no guarantee that the driving is going to be of a competency that does not invite scorn and contumely.
He styled out a wanker sign to visor adjustment.
Yeah.
Let's just go back a sec. So can I just get an image in my head? Because I've now been distracted by the image of two monks together watching the rugby. Were you in some sort of... Were you in a beer garden, or did you go scurrel away somewhere?
We had a telly room, which wasn't really... It was rather frowned upon, actually, but for major sporting tournaments, is indeed my vicarage is going to basically be a telly room for the month of June now as the football happens.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And what was the flavour of your monastery? I'm fascinated by the idea of...
It's the Anglican monastic, the Community of the Resurrection, which was founded by Bishop Gore at the end of the 19th century. And it was to found a monastic but also a kind of missional community in the north of England. And originally it was to train working class men in the West Riding, from the industrial north to train for ministry in the Church of England. It had a hugely influential effect. I mean, Trevor Huddleston is perhaps the most famous of its monks, who was a major figure. Archbishop Trevor Huddleston, a major figure in the anti-apartheid movement. And they were very active in South Africa and were involved with Desmond Tutu and Steve Biko and lots of people. They were an inspiring bunch of monks. They were mostly Old Etonians, which was quite weird.
Mm.
And I can remember we had we had some visiting monks from the Brother Monastery in Germany, in Trier, and they came along, and to greet them, they sang, as monks would do, and they sang the lovely plain song, Hymn the Haec Dies. And then the Merfield monks, the Merfield Fathers, they were known, they had to think of a song to sing back, but the only one they could all remember was the Eton Boating Song.
Oh,
so they sang that, and the German monks thought it was a hymn, but it wasn't.
That sounds like a sort of Boris Johnsonian diplomacy there. Just.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Eton is a, it can work for good or ill, I think. And there was something about the Etonianism of the Merfield Fathers, which directed towards beneficial ends, which was the fight against apartheid in South Africa. They were fantastic in that fight and really, really created an enduring legacy.
What do you do in a monastery then? Is it it's not just sitting there praying, because I've sort of got this sort of slightly simplistic, as with everything in my head, vision of a kind of medieval just sitting in a church praying. What actually happens on a sort of day-to-day basis? Study, I suppose.
Well, actually, no, you're pretty much right.
Oh, right.
It's mostly praying.
Right.
There's a thing called the Divine Office, which is the daily regime of prayer, and that's there are variations on it, but essentially you start very early saying prayers, you end quite early saying prayers, and in between you say a lot of prayers.
Right.
So it's a sort of factory of prayer interspersed with a bit of study and a bit of gardening and a bit of lavatory cleaning, right, and all that kind of thing. I absolutely loved it.
What's in the prayers? Are they just, is it your own personal prayers, or are you saying prayers on behalf of other people?
Yeah, there's a chunk for that, but mostly it's a set form of prayer. So it's based on the Psalms, which is the Book of Psalms of the Old Testament, which is actually the hymn book of the second Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And that's the basis of it. So you go through the whole, there's 150 Psalms, and you go through them all over time. And interspersed with readings and hymns and plain song. And I was the precentor, which is the one responsible for the singing. But I wasn't in the monastery ran a training college, and I was in the training college. So it was really a sort of para-monk rather than a full monk, if I can put it that way.
Right, okay, cool. Well, now I know. Now I understand more. This is good. This is enlightening. I like this.
My matey potato stir.
All right, let's move on then from a monastery to something bang opposite, I would say. This is 2008 now, Richard, and you have bought season 4 of The Wire. Still, I think, possibly the greatest bit of TV ever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love The Wire. I find it very hard to dethrone The Sopranos as my sort of favourite box set ever, although I watched it, a bit of it, a while ago, and I think it's not perhaps stood up to the test of time. I haven't rewatched The Wire.
Because I've got The Sopranos on my list of things to watch again. Are you saying The Sopranos hasn't stood up to the test of time, or The Wire hasn't stood up to the test of time?
I don't think The Sopranos is as good as I remember it, but I think it's because it was very early in the field of that sort of thing. But it is wonderful. I mean, there are creations in it. Paulie Knuckles, Livia, Tony Soprano's mother, who is this creature from hell, who's just amazing. Junior, he's wonderful. I mean, it is wonderful. But do you know what? I think that box set format now, people have got better and better at it. I've just been watching Narcos, which is one of my new favourites. And it is so, so, so slick and beautifully done, so polished. The shooting is wonderful.
I know.
And also the shooting is wonderful.
Both elements of the shooting. I love Livia Soprano. She's very... The Sopranos is very good as a... character guide for people in my life. My mother is a very Livia Soprano type character, and sometimes
murderous.
murderously narcissistic, and sometimes she has her narcissistic tantrums, and we have a shorthand with my brothers and my wife when I can just say she's gone full Livia Soprano. She's gone.
Oh, really?
It's very useful.
It's good.
It's a very useful shorthand. Yes, The Wire, very, very good indeed. And in fact, one of the actors mentioned on this on Amazon here is Dominic West. This was his sort of, I mean, people will rage at me saying he was famous before, but this was the beginning of him, wasn't it, really?
He came to read the lesson at our carol service in my last church.
Oh.
And I told him that I'd given The Wire box set to the vicar as a Christmas present, and he was genuinely very chuffed indeed to hear that the clergy of, well, it was Knightsbridge, and the clergy of Knightsbridge were all watching The Wire.
And does he read beautifully?
Yes, he did, but they always do, actors. Mm. Sometimes what you want... You want someone who reads beautifully. You don't want someone who's acting. The best reader of lessons was Judi Dench. I remember doing a funeral, and Judi Dench did the reading, and she was beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Really? What is it? Because they just bring it down a bit. They just make it more spare.
I think if you're an actor, particularly one who's trained in the classical Shakespearean tradition, you just know how to deliver a word.
Mm.
And it's not about, you know, it's not about emoting. It's they have confidence in the language to do all the heavy lifting, really.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So Dominic West didn't do it in the Baltimore accent. That's...
Now, I remember once having one, we had a lady did, it was the reading of John the Baptist and Advent Carol service. A voice crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. You think it's not a play script. It's scripture, it's different.
Cringe, that's so cringe. They happen at, I've been to lots of actors' weddings and you get lots of drama school students doing the speeches and really seeing it as a monologue, seeing it as an audition. And I'm practically prolapsing with cringe while they're doing it. It's the worst.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a professional with scripture, as I am, you learn that you need to be clear. And what you don't need to do is to interpolate your own kind of emotional index to it, because actually it's a bit dangerous to do that, because the Bible, the words are extraordinarily significant and the impact they can have and have had and continue to have is extraordinary. So you need to be really careful handling it.
Do you still have moments when you're reading things you've read hundreds of times before where it strikes you anew?
Oh, yeah, constantly. And also I think partly it's age. So at the moment it's music. So I'm playing a bit of piano music at the moment, which I used to play when I was a teenager, when I was actually as a player at my probably at my best. Mm. But like so many of the things you love in your teenagehood, I sort of went off them as a sort of repudiation of the things of youth. And now I'm nearly 60, I'm coming back to them, and it's like hearing them for the first time. I think, oh my God, this is absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
And I do it with novels too. I mean, I loved the novels of Thomas Hardy when I was a teenager, and then I thought they were too overwrought and, well, all sorts of things. And then I started rereading them again recently, and they're wonderful.
Yes, yeah. It's always good to do that. It's useful for me as someone who's got a terrible short-term memory. I can just come back to a novel that I read a year ago and go, oh, this is great!
Yeah, no, I mean, I do it with crime novels all the time.
Yes.
And I've read most of the Jack Reacher books
yes.
about six times, and it's usually the seventh time when I think, this is a bit familiar.
That's so true. Yeah. And no criticism of Lee Child, but they are...
No, I love them.
Similar. You know, they follow a similar pattern, which is why we love them, because they are genius.
And they're genius, and the genius is to kind of, you race through it, but I don't think it necessarily imprints deeply on your memory.
They're wonderful books, the Lee Child books. I'm obsessed with them. And you see people like A.C. Grayling and all sorts quoting on them, saying these are fabulous.
I've got a controversial theory that Jack Reacher is gay.
Yes, I could run with that.
I mean, he's so gay, and also... he has a fondness for quite camp things. There's quite often there's mention of a credenza. And I didn't know what a credenza was, so I phoned a friend in America, and she said it's a kind of fussy side table. And I'm thinking, why would Reacher want a fussy side table? And also, why would he know it was called a credenza? So I've tried to share this view on social media, and it was a bit like saying James Bond's gay, and it didn't go down great.
Oh well, James Bond totally gay. He's so broadcasting his heterosexuality, he has to be gay. He's protesting way too much.
Well, I mean, there is something, isn't there, about that which does sort of beg a question. But then I don't know. Perhaps it's the Johnny Wilkinson factor. Perhaps it's his charm is rather skews my judgment.
Well, there's that thing about Jack Reacher, isn't there? Men want to be him, women want to be with him. That's
yeah, and I think quite a lot of men actually want to be with him too,
yeah.
Maybe.
Oh yeah, I think I do, yeah. All right, okay, let's move on before I make any more admissions on the show today. So 2016, Reverend Coles, there's a couple of things in 2016 which I'm fascinated by. First of all, this looks, I've never seen one of these before. This is a premium stainless steel egg topper.
Oh, yes.
What is that? Like, I don't know what that is. I've never seen one of these in my life. Am I stupid?
It is... the most useless kitchen gadget I've got. It's not useless. It's, in fact, extremely good at the one thing it does, which is take the top off an egg, leaving a very, very straight line.
So like a cigar cutter, but for eggs.
Well, it's even better than that because it works through impact. It's spring-loaded and you pull up the little plunger thing and then you release it and it strikes the egg, which is held by the little kind of... it looks like the sort of cap you have on an electric chair on the floor.
Yes.
But what that does, it means it cleanly takes off the top, the crown of the egg. And I got it because I love cooking. And I went through a period when I was being taught fancy things by a wonderful chef who was lovely. And he showed me, you know, if you want a high-end egg, you need to get that crown off cleanly. And so I bought the stainless steel egg topper. It was quite expensive, as I recall.
Oh, really? I can't see how much it is on here. That's annoying. Oh,
I'm sorry about that. But listen, it ate peanuts.
Well, yes.
And I've used it. I've used it very occasionally to take the crown off an egg cleanly. And whenever I do, and I serve whatever's coming with it, people go, how do you do that?
I get,
you know, steady hand.
Surgeon's hands. Yeah. Vicar's heart, surgeon's hands. It looks like a torture device. It absolutely looks like a torture device. But
I mean, you could... I wonder if you put it on someone's big toe and just pinged it up and down really hard, it might... I mean, I'm sure there are more efficient ways of getting information out of someone who doesn't want to give it, but
yeah,
you could give it a go.
You could definitely torture someone with it. Also, it does mean I like the image of you doing it because you're in a rush first thing on a Sunday morning before you have to get to church. I think that's rather, you know, an efficient sort of thing to be doing. But then I'm sad because you're missing out on the great joy of a boiled egg, which is the getting the teaspoon and tapping all the way around it.
No. It's untidy.
Yes.
You get bits of shell everywhere.
Yes.
And also there's that bit where you're left with the membrane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Tom, try the stainless steel egg topper.
Okay.
Ask someone to give it to you for Christmas or birthday.
Yeah.
And people will look at you with new respect.
I need it. I've needed that for a while. To be honest, that might do the job. Okay. All right, fine. All right, egg topper, it's on my list. Elsewhere in 2016, 25th of November 2016, you've just bought a lovely clog. It's a delightful Joseph Siebel Men's Max Clogs. Excellent reviews. Nearly 5 stars out of 758 reviews on here.
Yeah, I mean, they are absolutely wonderful. And it's a trick I learned from the monks, actually. Quite a lot of the monks would wear these clogs under their cassocks. So they're smart black leather, so they look like you're making your Sunday best.
Yes.
But they are actually clogs, so you can slide them on and off.
Yes.
They're very comfortable, but they have the kind of sole you need, particularly as a man of my age, where fallen arches is a daily worry.
Oh, yeah.
And I highly recommend them. The problem is they are irresistible to sausage dogs, and they have chewed through, I should think, a dozen pairs.
Oh, isn't it worth buying a sacrificial pair for the dogs?
Well, I'm actually wearing a pair of sandals that were... I think it's my feet. What they really like is, you know, the foot sweat impregnating an organic material like leather. They can't resist it. It's catnip to them.
It
so
really is, isn't it? Human fluid sponge. That's just all they want, isn't it, dogs?
They do. They really do.
They are the worst. They're disgusting.
They are absolutely disgusting, particularly when, you know, they come at it fresh from a stool of some unknown animal that they've been sniffing around in the back garden. Usually a badger. Don't go there.
The problem I have, well, I have a very beautiful but very elderly labradoodle who has an enormous beard, full sort of Brian Blessed type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
She likes to snack on feces in the park that's been left by humans.
Yeah. Oh God.
And so so she'll get this sort of almost a sort of shitty brush dangling from her mouth, and she'll come home, and you'll think, oh, she's so lovely, and you'll give her a little kiss, and it's.
I know exactly. I've had the same issue, think there is. I so want that not to be what I suspect it is, but it is.
Yes. It's very hard to bounce back in your relationship with a dog.
There are certain things, aren't there, which you simply just—they're so awful. You have to edit them out of life.
Yes,
they never happened, and that would be one of the things that never happened.
Yes, it's just a stark reminder that they're bloody animals. They really are just animals.
I'll tell you another one like that, Tom. And it happened to me only on Saturday. I was going into London on the train, and I went to the loo and I pressed the button, and the door very slowly slid open to reveal an old lady going about her number two business, and. She looked at me just with horror. I looked at her and I turned my back and gallantly stood there with my back to her to give her a degree of much privacy as I could, and pressed the button to go back again to put the door back. And then, of course, when we got off the train at St. Pancras, there she was again, and there I was again, but we looked at each other and I knew that we had both officially decided that never happened.
It hasn't happened, and you definitely haven't made it eternal by putting it on this podcast. That's definitely not happened.
It didn't happen. So this is a hypothetical scenario.
Right, okay. And in this hypothetical scenario, did the door go very slowly in a sort of showbiz tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be? You know,
yeah, but it was inexorable. So I hit every button to attempt to get the bloody thing to close. But it didn't close. And apparently this happens all the time. A friend of mine is a train manager, and she said that it just happens 4 or 5 times on every trip because people don't understand the locking system, where you don't actually have a latch that you can lock. And I think this tells us something, doesn't it, about the failures of automation and technology, is that sometimes what you want is to draw a bolt, you know?
Not everything can be digital. Please don't digitise our locks. Also, can we spare a thought for the lady going for a poo and then seeing the Reverend Richard Coles appearing as if in a vision? Were you? Please tell me you were in full robes at this point.
I wasn't in a dog collar, which perhaps mitigated slightly. Of course, I was wearing a mask, so my identity was obscure. Perhaps she might mistake me for Zorro. I don't know.
Hello, it's Mr. P here.
I'm the other Mr. P.
And we are the hosts of Two Mr. P's in a Podcast.
The educational podcast where you don't actually learn a thing.
No, instead we explore the weird, wonderful and downright hilarious things that happen in school from people actually doing the job. We reminisce on our own time at school, funny things we experience each day. And of course, we share your hilarious stories from the chalk face. So if you work in a school or just want a nostalgic trip down memory lane, sit up straight, fingers on lips, and get ready for the lesson.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Let's keep things toilety for a while, shall we? And we'll talk about this, Richard, which I'm fascinated to see on your Amazon purchase history. It's the Tsunani. I think that's how you pronounce it. S-U-N-A-N-Y. It's Sunani, but I think it's Tsunani. It's the female urination device. This is a female silicon funnel, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. It's a shiwi.
A shiwi. Thank you.
Yeah,
right.
A shiwi.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Well, I got it for my friend Louise March, mm-hmm. Who is a garden designer in Buckinghamshire. And she is of a certain age now. And like many women of a certain age, issues around, you know, that thing when you're young, all you want to do is get your body fluids out. And when you're old, all you want to do is keep them in. And nature conspires against that sometimes. So she would often complain that life for her is getting a bit leaky. And so I thought I would give her a shiwi as a present. So because if we're caught short as men, it's an easy operation, isn't it? It's harder for women because of genital equipment. And what the shiwi does is kind of, I hesitate to say a strap-on, but you know what
it's
I mean?
It's got that element to it, yes,
it's
absolutely.
It provides a woman with a device wee more like a man, if it's a read. So I thought this was a magnificent present, and I sent it to her.
Yeah.
I think it was for her 50th birthday. I'm sure she was delighted, although I don't remember her actually thanking me for it.
Or ever speaking to you again.
Yeah, Louise March is her name. Louise March of Woburn Green, Buckinghamshire.
Full postcode. Go and see if you see someone in a garden using the lady's pee funnel right now. So, all right. So that was a present. Okay. Okay. It does seem like it does seem like invention, innovation, giving evolution a helping hand there. It seems very unfair. Certainly my experience at festivals, for example, it's awful when men, just so easy.
Well, I just think it is an outrage that, in a time when we're supposed to have understood something about sexual equality, that women have to queue around the block to have a pee, whereas we're in and out. Mm. And I've always thought, why don't you just double the size of women's facilities and half the size of ours, and it would sort of be more even, obviously inconveniencing oneself, but I think in the interest of fairness,
yes,
it would be good. But there's this new, they're developing this new kind of we thing for women. I saw it on the internet the other day. And it's like a sort of carousel with little wheel edges on. So you could get many more women in. There's not the it's not like going into a little box and closing the door and sitting down. Oh, my brother did the other day. We were in Scotland, right. And we were in a restaurant in an old lighthouse at the Mull of Galloway.
Oh, lovely.
And and my brother decided he went for pee, and we've heard that he'd actually fallen asleep in the lavatory during lunch. He'd gone to the loo just for a pee, but he'd had a little sit down, and he said, "Well, just close my eyes." And he'd fallen asleep on the loo in the restaurant. We had to bang on the door to get him to wake up to come for his pudding.
My God, talk about falling asleep at the wheel.
Yeah.
Well, was he having a sit down wee? Must have been.
I think he just thought he does like to, he does like a nap, and I think he just thought maybe I was droning on too much at lunch. I don't know. Maybe that was the thing. But he did just have a little sit down.
I
and fell asleep.
Find a power nap the most curative thing in the world.
Oh God, I don't.
Are you not a power napper? The world is divided. This is the new Brexit. 20 minutes, and I am absolutely done, because I get up very early for breakfast radio a lot, and I feel awful, and then I have a power nap, and I'm absolutely fine.
When do you have your power nap, Tom?
Usually I'm an 11 or 12-er, but then sometimes I'm too hungry before lunch. So then what I'll do is knowingly stock up on carbs over lunch.
Oh, that'll knock you out.
And then knock me out for just 20 minutes.
But it will literally be just 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, this is the other thing. Talking of Lee Child, this is a Jack Reacher-type skill. I can lie down, look at my clock. It can be 20 to 2, and I can have Richard Coles on at 2 o'clock, and I will fall asleep, and I'll be wide awake at 2 o'clock.
I would do anything for that, because I'm the worst sleeper. Me and David Baddiel, actually, are rival kings of the insomnia lab.
Oh, no.
And so I'm lucky. I sleep about 20 minutes a night. Well, no, I don't really, but I'm a terrible sleeper. Mm. And the thing is, as I've got older, and especially with that using a carb method, I will knock myself out. Sometimes I will simply fall asleep, usually watching something on television that I really want to see.
Yes.
I fall asleep. And then I wake up, but I feel worse than I did before.
The
power nap for me makes me feel like I've got a hangover.
Yes, yeah, that's awful. That's unfair. That's the worst thing about insomnia, and it's not the worst thing, of course, but and it's a similar thing to hay fever. Someone will always present you with a cure to it.
Oh, everyone. Yeah. I mean, my brother and my sister-in-law gave me a weighted blanket.
Yes.
Funny enough, when we were in Scotland, and I felt that I was just sort of being kind of tied to a bed in a psychiatric hospital underneath it. And the dogs didn't like it either. And they were determined that this would make me sleep better, but I don't think it did.
Oh, I like the gravity blanket. I find it very comforting. I liked it.
Do you?
Yeah, very.
Is it like an embrace or something?
Yes. I don't think I was loved enough as a baby, and I think this is definitely, there's something Freudian about it for sure. Swaddle me.
They gave me one. Yes. They gave me one, and I might just try it again. In this weather, though.
Well, no, for goodness sake, not in this weather. Very briefly on the falling asleep whilst weeing, I honked and honked at that image. However, it's occurred to me that several occasions we have a tiny ensuite bathroom, and I'm not going to lie to you, Richard, I like a sit-down wee. I think that's...
Do you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, this is the thing that really divides the world.
Oh, totally have a sit-down wee. Why stand up and spray wee everywhere and leave the toilet seat up? And you can sit down, get the phone out, get some quality time away from the children. But here's the thing. There's an ensuite by our bedroom, which I use, and there's a towel rail with towels on it right in front of the toilet. So I can lean my head forward almost as if in prayer, pop my head on the thing, and I have fallen asleep in the middle of the night whilst waiting. It's very nice, very comforting.
I wonder if narcolepsy is only a step away.
That's a good point.
But I do think also, I mean, I think I don't have children, and I've just noticed with friends of mine who do, is that once they've started having children, the idea of sleeping for more than 2 minutes at a time is gone forever.
Yes.
Unless you do and neglect them horribly and they lie in urine crying all night.
Yeah. Yes, but still you get good sleep, so priorities. All right, come on, let's move on then, shall we? See what else is lying in wait for us on the Reverend Richard Coles' Amazon purchase history. And this is an image which I'm going to take away from the show. It's a petrol chainsaw. It's a 58cc. It's a full-on Texas Chainsaw Massacre type scenario. Is this yours? Have you...
I bought it for David, my late partner, as a birthday present because he really wanted one. I'm a terrible present buyer, Tom. Oh. And the year before, I'd given him a leaf bag from the garden centre, which was £7.99. And he was so hurt and so angry. I thought, I've got to do better. So he wanted a chainsaw.
Yeah.
So I bought him a chainsaw for his birthday. And he loved a new toy. And so he started playing with it, whereupon our neighbour, Ned, in the old vicarage, came literally running. He's a big chap, Ned, very big and healthy American fellow. And he grew up in the woods of New England, and he rushed and he went, "Stop!" Because apparently chainsaws are quite dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
That's not true. Oh, that's health and safety gone mad.
Exactly, snowflakes.
Please.
So Ned then stopped. The next thing I knew, David was sort of wearing a chainmail pinny and so much protective equipment. He looked like he was Mad Max ice hockey player. And Ned was giving him a masterclass in how to use a chainsaw.
But did you have anything to cut down?
Yeah, a few things. We're quite... David is a very, very keen gardener, and he would sometimes get kind of structural. And so we've got lots of trees and stuff, and he liked to interact very positively with the natural environment.
Yes, okay. I that reminds me of my grandmother. She passed away very, very young, actually. And she was, many years ago now, but she was a huge gardener. No one else in the family really was. And I always remember that as a kid. I was only 6 or 7. And the comfort I got from even that at that age, I was really receptive to it, from seeing grand things growing around the garden.
Yeah.
Was a strong one. Do you have that now?
Well, it's wonderful because, I mean, David, he did, I'm just looking at it now, the garden is absolutely beautiful. Yeah. And it's like I get a bunch of flowers from him every day at this time of year because things, you know, that he planted come up. And I find that very comforting, actually, and delightful. And I sort of sometimes take little bunches of things that he particularly liked to put on his grave. Mm. He's very keen on yellow roses. We have a beautiful yellow rose called Lark Ascending, which was a piece of music he particularly loved. So I was out there with the gardener, Mr. Perkins, this morning to get some Lark Ascending to put on David's grave. And Mr. Perkins told me how much he liked the Lark Ascending too, and that he was out in his van 6 o'clock in the morning and he had Lark Ascending in the backed plant somewhere. And he stopped for a cup of tea and he put on the radio, yeah. Lark Ascending came on. At that moment, a lark flew up from the field into the sky and he looked at that and thought, it's beautiful. And then he said, a sparrowhawk came out of nowhere. And there was just a flurry of feathers. And I thought, that's fucking life for you, isn't it? I love Mr. Perkins.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I was about to say this is some sort of charming sign of you know, ethereal angels setting something up for him.
Yeah. It's nature red in tooth and claw, isn't it?
Bloody sparrowhawks.
Bloody sparrowhawks. I mean, a lark.
Oh, good, good. I always like a story that ends in a terrible, terrible murder. all right, what else have we got here? A little bit of Powell and Pressburger. So three Powell and Pressburger films, A Matter of Life and Death, Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, and I Know Where I'm Going, all from 1946, these ones. So this is a nice
or
box
thereabouts.
Set. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I love Powell and Pressburger. Who doesn't? I think if you're interested in... It's very interesting. I'm very interested in English art and culture because I think it manages to tell us something about England and invite us into an exploration of England without doing it in a way which is horribly, horridly political. So there is a story, a national story, a national culture that we're all stakeholders in. I'm sorry to use that word, but it just came into my mind.
No, it works. It works.
And I think Powell and Pressburger are very interesting. Also, of course, so many of the people who've most captivated us with their articulation of that image of Englishness aren't English. Hmm. Pressburger being one of them, John Betjeman, Dutch heritage, Elgar, Holst, yeah. Guillaume de Sens, who built Canterbury Cathedral. You know, all these people who give us these visions of Englandness aren't actually English. Richard Curtis, I mean, who in our own age has probably done that better than anybody else, but Richard is actually Czech by birth.
I didn't know that. Is he really?
Yeah, and he grew up in New Zealand, and he has an Australian passport. Oh. His father's Czech.
Well, Boris Johnson's got an American passport.
Well, he was an American citizen, although I think he renounced his American citizenship.
Oh.
Because he didn't want to get taxed by the IRS. Well, who can blame him?
It's true, though. It's true. What is it?
I think you need to be an outsider to give the inside of you. You know, I think those of us who live in it are born in it.
And
well, you're a Welshman. It's an interesting one for you. I mean, you're an outsider to that too, in a way.
Well, in a way, but then I'm in the most English part of Wales, Monmouthshire. I'm in this sort of no man's land where you can be both English and Welsh, and you don't really get. And also, there's a middle class thing as well. I mean, this is a big tangent for me, but I feel like as a Welshman, there isn't an accepted Welsh identity of being above working class. Whereas in Scotland, you'll get posh Scots, you know, that kind of posh Scot thing. You'll get a known stereotype. But in Wales, if you're not working class, you're almost not Welsh. So I've always had
That's really interesting. I suppose that's because we think of farmers in the Slieve Peninsula and then the cities of the south.
That's it. Yeah. And it's patronising to the working classes. It's patronising to Wales, and it annoys
But also, it misses something really important because you look at the history of Wales, particularly, I mean, think of people like Vaughan or the Herberts. They were people who were absolute, or the Tudors, preeminently, Welsh families who were hugely significant on a national and international stage. Mm. And now it's Bonnie Tyler, which is great, don't get me wrong.
No.
But she's probably never going to run the country. Wouldn't it be great if she did?
I'd be fully up for that. Fully up for that. She's an absolute legend. Yes. All right. Good. Powell and Pressburger films. I'm a big fan of war movies. They're tremendously comforting. I used to watch them with my father. It's just
lovely. I mean, the interesting thing about Powell and Pressburger is that they have this deeply mystical tinge to them, and the films are like a sort of Narnia for grown-ups, I think, because they imagine a version of what we know in this sort of supernatural but very compelling way. Supernatural, but actually that tells you stuff you really need to know about the natural. I love them.
There are supernatural twists in these films, and I didn't realise that.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I've never seen any of these movies, I should say. I'm a complete ignoramus.
Oh, listen, yeah, Tom, I'll start with The Matter of Life and Death, because that is a war film. They're all wonderful, but my favourite one now is I Know Where I'm Going, but it's a very strange little beast.
Know that. Okay, good. Thank you. Will do. Good. Lots of recommendations coming from the show today. I'm going to have beautiful eggs and, you know, a good collection of old films. Talking of old things, New Testament Greek manuscripts, £45 on these.
Well, it's technical stuff, isn't it? The stuff you need for work. I mean, my academic field is New Testament textual criticism, which means that, I mean, it's different now because of the internet, everything sooner or later will be accessible that way. In fact, it is. But my bookshelves, I'm looking at my bookshelves in my study now, are crammed with books like that, which are, the reason they're 45 quid is because literally there are four people who are going to buy it. So they need to price it accordingly.
Right.
So there's me and the three people who work in my field. Right. Who buy that book. I think the one I bought that was just the Epistle to the Romans, I think.
Right. Okay. So this is something you did when you were studying, or do you still go to these now?
I keep my hand in it now, actually. I mean, I did. Because I haven't been a generalist all my life. When I was in the monastery, I thought what I'd really like to do is kind of concentrate on one thing. Yeah. And I've always really loved New Testament Greek, and I got really interested in so my field is textual transmission. So it's not interpreting what's written in it. It's interpreting how it reached its written form. So it's looking at the history of how the text we have today got to us. And that's incredibly complicated. You're looking at the best part of 2,000 years of stuff. And it's one of those things where it's highly technical and highly focused, but it'll tell you everything you need to know about everything if you give it your attention.
And do you need to go through layer by... Is this something that's been retranslated again and again and again, and hence a sort of Chinese whispers thing happens?
Yes, but it's more different editions. So there are different sort of families of texts. I mean, people argue about everything, but there are certain set of texts are associated with Alexandria in the sort of second, third century, a certain set of texts associated with Gaul in France for a bit later, and then there's the Byzantine text. So there's text families, if you like, and all of them differ very, very slightly. Sometimes it's literally a letter or a word.
Why?
But oceans of ink have been expended on working out. Well, that means that it's important because, you know, the Bible has shaped and continues to shape so many people's lives that sometimes an awful lot can hang on a single stroke of a pen.
Well, this is the thing. My friend Tim was telling me, he's Catholic, he's very, very up on his faith. And the quote, and I'm going to completely mangle it now, lying with another man is a sin. And he said that the original word was shame, is a shame, not a sin. And it's this kind of interpretation, which is fascinating that people have
And also there's the word which sort of conservative interpreters of scripture would take to mean someone like me, a gay man, in the the usage of its time meant something different. It would have been a temple prostitute. And one of the things we do, and it's something we need to be very alert for, is that we don't read into ancient texts the script of our own age. You know, you have to, you know, the Bible's important. We owe it our best reading, and that means sensitive and thoughtful.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what else you owe yourself is your best possible food options, and you've really gone for that here with this. Some caviar, some Attilus caviar, 250 grams, currently unavailable. So you obviously have emptied Russia, I assume, of caviar here.
Yeah, this is very controversial now, Tom, because it is not obtained in a way which is consistent with the highest animal welfare standards.
Oops.
Although there are now caviar, farmed caviar, which is obtained much more humanely. But I'm afraid I do have a terrible fondness for caviar, which is the most Moorish thing in the world, I think after crack cocaine. It's a bit dearer than crack cocaine, though. But I do absolutely love it. And I have a very rich friend who sometimes takes me out for dinner. Yeah. And she's extraordinarily generous and lovely. And she takes me to this place where they had a caviar trolley.
Oh, wow.
She said, let's do caviar. That'd be wonderful. So I looked at the caviar menu and it was surprisingly reasonably priced. I said, that's really surprising.
Give us an example. Give us a number here. Come on.
Well, I'll get to it. Okay. But it was modestly priced. I'm not going to say it's not chicken McNuggets, right?
Sure,
but
sure.
It was modestly priced. So anyway, the caviar trolley came out. I thought, well, we'll have some of that. So I had some beluga, had some ossietra, had some savruga, had some Cornish caviar, mountains of it, all served up beautifully with blini, chopped egg, all the kind of stuff you have with it. And it was wonderful. And then at the end, I realized that the price in the menu was per gram. And she, without wincing, and she didn't show me the bill, but I kind of stole a look at it while she went to the loo, and it was £800 just for the caviar.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mind
it's
you,
bad, isn't it?
If anyone's been to the Pick and Mix at the Odeon Cinema,
you could easily hit £800 there.
Easily. That is easily done. Easily done. Wow. Okay. Mountains and mountains of caviar. It does look good. I mean, it's fish eggs, isn't it, caviar?
It's fish eggs, but it's the eggs of the sturgeon, which is a very noble fish indeed. And there is, I genuinely really, really love it. But so in the end, we just used to have it on Christmas Day because it is ridiculously expensive. So I would shop around finding the most modestly and approachably priced caviar before Christmas.
Is there a Waitrose Essential caviar? Does that exist?
I think Waitrose, I don't know, it's a special order, I think.
Okay.
And now the other thing about it is made even more expensive. I mean, when I was in Russia at the end of the Soviet Union, 1990-91, you could get 500 grams of beluga for $25.
Wow.
And that's really where I acquired the taste for caviar.
Yes.
And Russians love a party. So caviar, Georgian champagne, and very, very plain white Russian unsalted butter is how you would do it. And it was wonderful.
Yes. Once you've had something at a certain price point, though, it's hard to accept change.
You're not going to get 500 grams of beluga it has gone up more than 1,000 times in price.
Oh.
So it's a luxury I can no longer afford. It caused a bit of a row between me and David because David didn't like it as much as me. And so sometimes I would sneak into the fridge and help myself to more caviar than is my fair share. And he used to go mental. You don't even like it. I kind of like it. You don't like it as much as me, which means I should be entitled to have at least 75% of the caviar. We never resolved that one.
I hope you send up an apology every time you gorge on caviar now.
Do you know, I can't remember the last time I did gorge on caviar because I've not been able to be taken out to dinner by my rich friend because there's been nowhere open. But I will drop some heavy hints.
Yes, yes. I definitely think that's one of the most serious complaints about the pandemic thus far. It's been very hard for me.
It's not just a first world problem. It's a 1% first world problem. But you know, seriously, the reason why the price has soared is because there are so many Russians now in London who are extraordinarily rich and will pay anything for things they desire. Those sort of trappings of wealth, because many Russians lived for a very long time without access to the trappings of wealth, so they go a bit mad.
Well, why is there a big Russian community in London? Are they exiles?
Tax.
Oh, tax.
Yeah, tax.
Right.
I mean, there are various reasons. It is, if you're an extraordinary, and I know this because my previous parish was Knightsbridge, which is probably, must be either the richest or second richest neighbourhood in London. And there were quite a lot of Russian, very wealthy Russians who lived there, who did, partly because they found it expedient not to live within the jurisdiction of President Putin for one reason or another.
Yeah.
Partly because there are tax reasons why you might want to shelter colossal wealth in the UK. Partly because of housing, because there was so much growth in London housing values. And partly because it's, they like London. It's a fun place to be. And so they would, we would often run into them. They would sometimes have, I remember doing a wedding, it was a Russian wedding, and the bride's dress was £50,000. And I remember it cost £12,000 to dry clean it.
Wow.
£100,000 on flowers, I think. Wow. I mean, it was, and also because, again, it's to do with Russian culture, I don't want to deal in caricature, but you often felt that there was a sort of competitive wedding giving between the various oligarchs, so they would go for bigger and better than their rivals.
Yes.
And,
you could just have great fun as an observer of that, like a tennis umpire just watching it.
It was slightly disgusting, though, Tom, after a while, when you just looked at the amount of money that went, people are free to spend their money within the law how they want, but there is something that's a little bit disgusting about by nighttime, our churchyard was filled with homeless people who had nothing, and whose lives were very tough and hard. And by daytime, it was full of people who were so rich they never, not earning money wasn't the problem, spending money was the problem.
Mm.
How the hell am I going to spend all this money?
And would you ever feel it in your job remit to approach the oligarch getting their daughter getting married with you and talk about the charitable giving that your church was trying to do? Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
And, yes, that's your job. What's the point of being a Christian in the richest neighbourhood in London? Well, the point is you build relationships with people who have surplus wealth and find out ways in which they could use that to provide a public benefit. And they're different. The Russians were interesting. They were very generous, but they needed to have their name on something. So if you could say, well, it'd be great if you gave that one. It can be the, Igor Bolokov Center for whatever. Then they would be enormously generous. And you learn to ask the right amount because, normally if you're a vicar, you're thinking, maybe I can get 50 quid off this person.
I see, yes.
Whereas if it's an oligarch, you're thinking, maybe I can get 500,000 quid off this person.
That's what you have to do, right? You have to pitch it, because if you go in too low, they're offended by how low it is, right?
Yeah, and people can be surprisingly, extraordinarily generous, and we're off of that.
Mm. Okay, good, good, good. Right, we're getting towards the end of the episode, Richard. I've really enjoyed this.
Me too.
So much fun. To find out the truth about you. And it's also another note I need to make here is to get an oligarch on the show. Imagine,
get one.
Imagine that. All right, finally, a final couple of things. Two more things. We've got Ferrari men's linen hooded robes, a thick caftan Saudi Arabic dresses. It's just a summer long shirt, isn't it, according to this?
It's a caftan. I started wearing caftans. I'm wearing one now.
It's lovely. Very good for the hot weather, because you can give it a little sort of willow, can't you? You can give it a shake and get some draft moving.
They are incredibly well adapted to hot weather. Also, they make me look a bit less fat, although I have got a sort of muffin top. Well, it's more than a muffin. It was like a bakery, in fact. But but if I kind of stand in the right angle, the fall of the caftan doesn't kind of get trapped by that. Mm. And I kind of look in the mirror and I think, oh, I'm quite thin today.
Well, the picture here, the man wearing it here looks very handsome. He's got a medallion on and everything. No, but I'm imagining.
It's a trick I learned from the great Sir Roy Strong, who I had lunch with in his wonderful house, not far from where you're from, the Lascet in Herefordshire.
Oh, yeah.
And Roy, in the summer months, would wear nothing but sort of caftans and sort of linen shirts and trousers from Pakistan and places like that. And I thought, he's so right. But then he's always so right. Yes. So I took that clothing tip from Sir Roy Strong.
I remember Sir Roy Strong. Has he passed away? Is he still?
No, he's still with us, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah, he used to come and do the speeches at our school, of course, because he was nearby. That makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's such a lovely man.
Yes, he was fantastic. Yes.
He wrote a wonderful memoir.
Yes, yes.
A few years ago.
Yeah.
And having lunch there is his garden is breathtakingly beautiful.
I'm sorry, but Herefordshire, I would say this because I was born there, the Herefordshire going into Brecon Beacons, that sort of border territory there, it is the most beautiful landscape in this country. It is unreal how gorgeous it is.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've got a friend of mine who lives near Hay, and he took me for a big walk on Brecon Beacons. His idea of a big walk is SAS big walk.
Yes.
My idea of a big walk is end of the garden. You know? but I was just absolutely knocked out by how beautiful it was. I remember, I must be looking at the Usk Valley, or is it the Wye Valley? One of those valleys. And it was the silver ribbon of a river just unwinding through this exquisite landscape. And you could see for miles.
Sugarloaf as well. Did you see Sugarloaf from where you were?
Isn't that Rio de Janeiro? I would be surprised to see that from Hale Wye.
It's very high. It's very We've got our own Sugarloaf there as well. Good. All right. So not so much Vicar in a tutu as Vicar in a caftan there. Yeah. Very nice. And then finally, here we go. This is a nice domestic note to leave you on, Richard. It's a microfiber scrubber, to quote Withnail. You've bought yourself a scrubber. It's a window cleaning kit. It's got a good long telescopic handle.
Oh, well, you need that for your upper stories. But I'll tell you why, Tom, because in lockdown, when nothing was moving, the vicarage windows did begin to look a bit, you know, unwashed, because they were. And it's like cutting a lawn. I know we're not meant to do that in No Mo May, but if you cut the lawn, if you clean the windows, the benefit is far greater than the effort you expend. It just looks great and you feel great. I like the world to be orderly. And so a cut lawn and a washed window. You're laughing. What? And this has all the technology that I need to achieve the effect I'm after.
First of all, what's No Mow May?
Well, I can't mow in May in order to encourage wildlife. So in our churchyard, we've left half of it to nature now.
Yes.
And it's causing rather a controversy because we have a beautifully kept churchyard. And there's a bit of a division in the community between those who think unmown churchyard is fine, and those who want it to look manicured. And so we've compromised, so we've done both. But the wilding bit is beautiful. We've got all sorts of things happening in there.
Yes. Rewilding is great because it's obviously very good for the planet, but also it means I don't have to do anything.
The trouble is, though, I mean, you think it's enough, isn't it? You think not to mow the lawn.
Yeah.
And you think, it's okay, I'm just promoting the environment. I'm actually being a good citizen, but actually just looks dreadful.
Yes. Oh, look, there was a good tweet from a bird just as you said that. Perfect. Yeah. A bird in the distance enjoying.
Jumping around.
Enjoying. Yeah. And has this window cleaning device got some sort of hose built into it? Is that how it works?
No. I mean, I didn't really want to. It was beyond my budget. So I did one which just had telescopic poles and then a sort of squeegee head thing. So there's quite a bit of, and also one of those things that professional window cleaners use. There's a technique to this, Tom. You know, they're like a windscreen wiper on a stick thing.
Yes.
And it's just to make sure you don't streak, because streaking
mustn't streak.
Is the bane.
Oh, well, as
of
a vicar as well.
Cleaner.
Big trouble if you end up streaking. Mustn't do.
Remember, streaking? That's the thing we were talking about, things that happen when we were kids that don't happen now, and streaking.
I mean, this is what upsets me about when they always. The cameras never stay on the streaker. They used to. All the pictures of Beefy Botham standing next to that chap. Brilliant.
Well, that's an editorial thing, as it's considered. You don't do that because it just encourages copycats. And it does interrupt play. Remember Erica Rowe at Twickenham?
I met her.
Did you?
Yes.
I heard she lives in Portugal now, doesn't she? Growing stuff.
Yeah, they flew her over for a 100 Greatest Sporting Moments thing, and I was on after her. And she came out, and I was like, I am getting a selfie with you.
Was she nice?
Oh, delightful. Baffled that this was still going on all these years later. And then she was heading straight to the airport to fly back to Portugal. Absolutely spot on. Yeah.
But it is one of the enduring images of Britain in the 70s, was Erica Rowe, the Twickenham Street.
Yes. Yeah, it's incredible, isn't
good
it?
Good honour.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a better image to define a decade than, you know, something like Brexit or something like that. It works very
well. Yes, or the winter of discontent.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Let's take that away from the 70s. All right, listen, Richard, thank you so much for coming on My Mate Bought a Toaster.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
It's been so lovely. I feel armed with recommendations. A recommendation which you've been far too modest to mention, which I'm going to do, is The Madness of Grief, your latest book, which I've started reading, and it is absolutely wonderful. Your writing is sensational, and I can't wait to read the rest of it. And that's out now, so there you go.
Thank you. Available on Amazon for about 14 quid.
There you are. 14 quid. Stick it on your list. Richard, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure, Tom.
Oh, I love him. It's Richard Coles on My Mate Bought a Toaster. I feel sad that it's over, but I only had an hour with him. And I had to stop when I got to 61 minutes because I felt bad for taking a minute extra of his time, because he's got to be one of the busiest men in showbiz and godbiz, hasn't he? And that's what I think one of the things we love about him is that, you know, he's doing so much stuff. Certainly after speaking to him just now, there's so many things going on, and yet he seems so placid and calm and centred. What an excellent human, and I hope you have enjoyed spending an hour with him as much as I have. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and write a nice review if you get a chance. If you don't worry, it's all fine. That was quite passag. If you don't worry. Yeah, it's fine. No, I understand. You're busy. Cool. Yeah, what are you? Are you a vicar and a showbiz superstar? Hmm? And doing panel shows all the time? Are you? You're not. So write a nice review. All right. Slightly barbed ending to the show. Didn't mean to do that at all. Back soon. See you soon. Bye, bye, bye. Don't leave me. Don't leave me. How do we have to part? I can't. GreatBigOwl.com. Oh, hello you. My name's Tom Price.
Hello, I'm Dave Cribb.
You should come and join us. Every day we do a podcast called Cabin Fever, where we talk to loads of comedians who've had to cancel everything else in their lives, so they come on our podcast instead, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, it's an isolation podcast.
Dave, were you yawning at the start of that sentence then? Was it just a little yawn?
Yeah, it's basically the Great Big Owl isolation podcast. We'll have people on from all our podcasts, from your Rule of Threes, your Brian Rogers, your Musicals, your Bitchins. If you like any of our podcasts, if you like any of those people, chances are they'll be logging onto the Zoom call and just chatting, because let's face it, they got nothing else to do.
Also, there'll be a quiz on the bill. All right, see you soon. Lots of love.
Cabin FE 83709. Oh, that's our Twitter name.